Today is March 4th.
I appreciate that. I'm honored.
March 4th, Thursday morning at the JCC, in the framework of the former Beit Midrash of North Texas. We're studying this semester Jewish mysticism and Kabbalah. And we've spent, I think, about 6 weeks on our introductions, whether it's the biblical period with the commentators, whether it's the Talmudic period, and now we've gotten to the classic period of Kabbalah. So I'm going to make a few short introductions, but 90% of our class will spend, of course, on learning texts. So the first thing I want to say is that we could make a distinction when we're studying the classic period of Kabbalah between three different types of Kabbalah. Theoretical Kabbalah, meditative Kabbalah, and practical Kabbalah. And I will very succinctly try to define what I mean by these three types of Kabbalah. The first type of Kabbalah is theoretical Kabbalah. Theoretical. And what we mean by theoretical Kabbalah is simply the effort to understand the nature of things.
The effort to understand the nature,
the nature of things. Why do I say things? Because I didn't yet define yet what is the thing that Kabbalah focuses on.
What's the definition again?
Simply the effort to understand, to map out, to fathom the structure of, let's say, the spiritual worlds. Okay. The effort to map out and to understand, to fathom the spiritual worlds. That's theoretical Kabbalah. Meditative Kabbalah is the effort to enter those spiritual worlds. In other words, it's the blueprint to get there, to be there. Once you're there, you will experience what the theoretical Kabbalah maps out. But how do you get there? That's meditative Kabbalah. So again, let me say it again. Theoretical Kabbalah is the theory. It's the structure of things. It's the philosophy, the theology. It's the inner structure of these spiritual worlds. Whereas meditative Kabbalah is how to get there, how to be in those spiritual worlds. It's the methodology of personal activity and personal spirituality that brings you to an awareness of and an interaction with those spiritual worlds. And the third type of Kabbalah is practical Kabbalah. And practical Kabbalah I can define in one word. Magic. Practical Kabbalah is what moderns would call magic. The effort to utilize spiritual insights to manipulate reality.
Okay. So that deals with all the numismatic stuff, all the symbols, all the other...
All the efforts to create gold, to create silver, to create a golem, right? To manipulate the spiritual worlds. Partly.
Yeah.
So we are not going to deal with practical Kabbalah. I didn't say that.
No, we're not old enough. We're not old enough here.
I'm not getting into that. We're just not going to deal with it. And we're also not going to deal so much with meditative Kabbalah. A little bit. Not going to deal with practical Kabbalah. We're not going to deal with meditative Kabbalah. We are going to deal with theoretical Kabbalah.
Number one.
Okay. And the truth is that 90% of the Kabbalistic manuscripts are about theoretical Kabbalah. There's very little written about meditative Kabbalah. There's very little written about practical Kabbalah. What's written and what usually is referred to as Kabbalah is theoretical Kabbalah. The understanding of the mapping out of the mechanisms and the structures of the spiritual worlds.
That doesn't sound like the kind of thing that Adana studies. Which aspect of Kabbalah do you think they are saying they are teaching?
I suppose that she's... I don't know. I suppose she's dealing with theoretical Kabbalah.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because that's really what's out there. With with an effort to make it relevant to the human soul.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that relevance even today.
I'm trying to understand how they gave the name practical Kabbalah to magic, because practicality means it makes sense.
No. Practicality doesn't mean it makes sense. It means that it's practiced in the world, that you practice it in the world.
Oh.
Theoretical Kabbalah is not practiced. Meditative Kabbalah is not practiced physically. It's practiced in your mind. Whereas practical Kabbalah makes the Kabbalah practical. Like, get rich, you know, like, make a golem.
In other words, if you say a person is a practical person,
it means has a good profession, right? And he does something in the world.
He's doing something that makes sense.
No, he's doing something that makes money.
No, doesn't necessarily make sense. And some practical person is somebody who knows how to get things done.
Yeah.
That's what a practical
person is. So
it's
magic.
Magic gets things done.
Harry Houdini was a very practical magician.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Let's go on.
Okay, meditative Kabbalah. You said enter into the world, the meditative.
Meditative Kabbalah is the methodology to help one enter into the spiritual worlds, to experience the spiritual worlds, not just to theoretically map them out, but actually to be there.
Actually do it.
To do it.
Yeah.
Like meditation, right?
Yeah.
We'll do a little bit of meditation as time goes on, but just a little bit. Okay, I'm going to go on now, and I'm going to talk about the basic books and the basic personalities that we'll be studying. So the world of Kabbalah is as rich and as broad as the world of Jewish philosophy. If in our study of Jewish philosophy, in the past 4.5 years, we've mentioned 100 different authors and 100 different books, well, in Kabbalah, there are thousands of different authors and books. It's a whole world. It's really larger than the world of philosophy. So can mention only a portion of a portion of a fraction of a fraction. But having said that, let's mention a few books that we'll be dealing with. Harry.
The sheet you just passed out is called Classic Kabbalah. Which one of the three does that fall under?
I use the term Classic Kabbalah to refer to this whole world of Kabbalah, excluding the biblical period that we did already, and excluding the Talmudic period that we did already. That you could look at as a pre-Kabbalah, the foundations of Kabbalah. Again, the biblical verses and the interpretations of the rabbis from the Talmudic period. We could look at that as pre-Kabbalah. But now we're talking about the classic Kabbalah, and the classic Kabbalah is divided into these three.
Parts. Excuse me, so that, does that begin then roughly with the age that they start writing all this material and with the age of the Ari?
I'm about to talk about that right now.
Okay.
Got to talk that right now. So the books of classic Kabbalah, and again, there's just so much there, but we're going to talk about Sefer HaBahir. This is an English translation of the Bahir. Sefer HaBahir.
Ari Kaplan.
By Ari Kaplan, the translator. And the Sefer Yetzirah, also translated by R.A. Kaplan. I'll write on the board. And then the Sefer Zohar, and the different permutations of Sefer Zohar. So we can talk about Sefer HaBahir, which means the Book of Illumination. And we can talk about Sefer HaYetzirah, which is the Book of Creation. And we could talk about Sefer HaZohar, which is the Book of Splendor.
Rabbi, I don't understand anything about Kabbalah, but I would like to know, when did it really begin being practiced?
Okay, so let's not say being practiced,
well,
let's say being studied.
All right.
Right, so you missed a lot of what we did in the past 3-4 weeks.
Yeah.
We've been talking about the roots of the Kabbalah. And the roots of the Kabbalah, of course, are in the Bible. Right, as we saw. And then we saw in the later periods that the rabbis are dealing and studying and explicating the verses in the Bible that lend themselves to Kabbalah.
So it's biblical.
So really, in a sense, you can say it goes back to the Bible. So again, we saw the roots in the Bible, we saw the development of the roots among the Talmudic rabbis, we saw hints of mysticism in Talmudic passages, but we really didn't flesh out what it means to study mysticism. That we didn't do already. That's what we're doing right now. And where do we find in the first text that seems to deal with these things of the structure of the inner worlds and mysticism and coming close to God? Sefer HaBahir and Sefer HaYitzirah and Sefer HaZohar. All three of these works are pseudo-epigraphic. Pseudo-epigraphic. Sounds like a big word. It is a big word. But you hear the first part of the word pseudo, and everyone knows that means like...
some imitation.
Imitation, kind of.
Yeah.
What it means is pseudo-epigraphic. It means later works that are attributed to earlier authors. Sefer HaBahir is attributed to, by Kabbalist, Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana. Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana, who was a Tana, who was a rabbi of the Tanakh period. Sefer Yetzirah is attributed to none other than Avraham Avinu, to Abraham. Sefer HaZohar is attributed to, as many of us know, who knows who it's attributed to?
Shimon ben Yochai.
Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, who was a Tana. And as far as we know scientifically and historically, the works, the authors that these works are attributed to are not the real author of the work. Sefer Yetzirah was probably not written by Avraham Avinu, and Sefer HaBahir was probably not written by Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana, and Sefer HaZohar was almost certainly not written by Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Rather what? Sefer HaBahir surfaces, becomes known in 12th century Spain. Sefer Yetzirah becomes known a little bit earlier than that.
Wait. So that's almost the same period with Nachmanides.
With 100 years before that.
Yeah, but this is, but Nachmanides is basically in the mystic.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Sefer Yetzirah, we don't know when it was created. It surfaces in Spain in the early medieval period. Sefer HaBahir, also in the early medieval period, about the 1100s, Sefer HaBahir surfaces. Sefer HaZohar surfaces in 1208 in Spain. So now we have to be careful. We have to be very careful, and I'm talking about the type of care that we've related to many times in this class, and it's true all the more so concerning Kabbalistic texts, which
Let me ask you one more question, please, so that I have my head, so I understand. All these three books then surface in Spain.
As far as I know,
okay,
yes.
Okay, so it's really under the original Sephardi community.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So now let's be careful. The fact that a book surfaces in a certain period might mean, probably means, it was edited at that time, but it doesn't mean that it was, that its material was created at that time. Its material can go back hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of years. Sefer HaBahir, which surfaced in the 12th century, the 1100s in Spain, in the group of Kabbalists led by what's called Rabbi Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, in English, Rabbi Isaac the Blind, surfaced in his circle, almost certainly was edited by his circle, but almost certainly was not created by his circle. They took ancient manuscripts, and they took ancient traditions and material they had developed, and they put it into a book. The book certainly bears their imprint, and the book itself in that form certainly doesn't go back 1,000 years, Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana, but the material in it, right, the foundations of the material, the kernels of the material, might just go back that far to the Tanakh period. The book in its present form, though. And the book, with all its wealth of information, no. But the material within it, the kernels of the material, certainly can go back hundreds upon hundreds of years. That's true concerning Sefer Vayir, it's true concerning Sefer Yetzirah, and it's true concerning Sefer Zohar. They're medieval works as far as the redaction goes. But the material in them and the kernels of the tradition go back hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of years.
Now, are these actual books, are they scrolls? When they were found? When they surfaced?
Oh, the Concordia. The Concordia is already in existence.
Because there's a difference.
No, but the Concordia...
Right.
Could give you a clue as to when they were created.
Right. We're talking about books. We're talking about books.
Yeah, by that time, Harry, the book has already been invented. Replace the scroll.
Yeah,
the book is
still
at that
time. Yeah, where was it? Where was the book?
No.
Where was the book? What do you mean, where was the book?
When something surfaces, it has to surface somewhere.
Well, when the book surfaces, when Sefer Vayir surfaces in the circles of Rabbi Yitzchak Sagi Nahor, Isaac the Blind, they have a book. They claim the book, of course, was copied from an ancient manuscript, which was copied from an ancient manuscript, which was passed on for 1,000 years. Most probably, that claim is true only partially. It's true that the material, parts of the material, were passed on, but in the present form that it surfaced, when it surfaced, it was...
Could it be that in order for those books to get credibility at the time, because they were so esoteric and so different, they said they came from way behind, just like many authors in the Bible?
Of course.
They gave names to people.
Of course.
A name.
Of course, that's pseudo-epigraphic.
Yeah.
Pseudo-epigraphic writing. But again, we have to be careful. The fact that it's pseudo-epigraphic, that it's attributed to an author who didn't write it, doesn't mean that the material is not ancient. The redaction is ancient. The redaction is only in the time the book surfaced. But the traditions, whether they were oral or whether they were written, probably some of them, many of them, part of them, or kernels of them, go back really a long, long time. And that's why it's kind of... And that's why you can't say the following. Sefer HaZohar. The Kabbalists say was written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. The academics say it was written by Rav Moshe Dilon in 1208. Who's right? You can't say yes or no. They're both right. The academics are right that the book in that form was only from 1208. But that doesn't mean that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai made it up in the year 1208. Most of the material he got in tradition. He reworked it, but he got it. And he got it in tradition, from someone who got it in tradition, got it in tradition, and each generation is reworked, and it's developed, and it's different manuscripts put together. It's not a simple thing to say, yes or no, the academics are right, the Kabbalists are right. They're both right. Okay? That's really important.
What was the first name of the Leon Rabbi?
Rav Moshe DeLeon.
And what was the name of the blind Rabbi?
DeLeon. The Zohar is written by... Rabbi Moshe Dilon in 1208 in Spain, and Sefer Vayir comes from the circle of Rav Isaac the Blind.
What is Dilon the same as Moshe de Cordova?
No.
Okay.
But let's mention Rav Moshe Cordovero. After these three foundational works, we want to talk about the Kabbalah of Tzfat, of Safed, in the 15th century. No, the 16th century.
16.
Sorry about that. In the middle 16th century. When there was an expansion, explosion of Kabbalistic activity, and the two main authors in Tzfat in the 16th century are the following. The Ari, of course, Ha'ari. And the Ha'ari is an acronym
before Rabbi Yitzhak Luria. Rabbi Yitzhak Luria. And if you ask why is it called Ha'ari, Ha'ari calls, stands for the...
that lion?
It sounds like the lion, right. But it stands for the holy Rabbi Yitzchak. Ha'ari stands for the holy Rabbi Yitzchak. Ha'kadosh. Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, and then we have Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, who's known by his acronym, the Ramak. Rav Moshe Cordovero. And there are literally thousands more. Almost all of the great Hasidic writers were developers of the Kabbalistic tradition. For example, all of you have heard of Chabad, right? Chabad is really a mystical movement in its foundation, and the foundational work of Chabad Hasidut, does anyone know what it's called?
Yeah, what? The Lubavitch?
The Lubavitch foundational work.
No, no, it's Sefer Yer... Oh, I've got it. I've got Steintzel's...
Right.
It's an acronym. Each letter stands for something like that. Love is Chachma.
No, but I'm asking, what is the foundational work of Chabad Hasidut? It's called the Tanya.
Tanya, yeah.
Right? And the Tanya is the work of Kabbalah.
Yeah, but
the work of Kabbalah.
Doesn't that become kind of... The Hasidic movement is a successor to the Kabbalists, right? But it becomes an Ashkenazi version,
okay,
if you will.
Right. It's a,
no, no,
it's a version, yeah. It's a version of Kabbalah.
It's not bad or good. It's just they then bring it into the Ashkenazi world.
And I can say in one sentence the direction that Hasidut took Kabbalah, and that's the following: if Kabbalah, and of course we're talking about theoretical Kabbalah, is a description of the spiritual worlds, Hasidut takes the spiritual worlds and applies them to the human psyche. It takes the insights of the structure of God's spiritual worlds and applies them to the structure of man's spiritual world. And we'll see that today.
Yeah.
We'll see that today.
Adel says what Hasidut does is allows the human being, the individual, to intervene with God and get God.
Okay, that's a different aspect I'm not talking about.
Yeah.
Okay, that's, I'm not talking about that. Yeah. So here, let me just mention, we can mention the Tanya, right? As a later work of Kabbalah. And we can also mention some names you've heard of. Rabbi Nachman Mibraslav, right? He was a great Kabbalist. And his writings are Kabbalistic writings that take the insights of Kabbalah, again, the insight into the theoretical structure of the spiritual world, and he shows how the structure of the spiritual worlds can teach you something of the structure of your own psychological world. And we'll also talk about Rabbi Tzaduk HaKohen miLublin. Rabbi Tzaduk HaKohen from the city of Lublin, who died in the year 1900, who as a Hasidic writer, was a great Kabbalist, who was taking Hasidic insights and making them shed light on the inner workings of the human spiritual world. All these introductions, I hope, will start to make sense as we begin. And now we're beginning. Okay, I'm going to erase this. This is just to give it a little hint and effort to be able to put in some type of framework the things we'll talk about. Okay, Kabbalah, here we go. What's Kabbalah? The fundamental issue that all of Kabbalah springs from is the interrelation of God and the world. The interrelation of God and the world. On one level, the question is the following. How does the one interact with the many? How could God, who is one, who is simple, who is other, who is transcendent, how could the one have any connection, any interaction with this world which is full of multiplicity? How could the spiritual interact with the physical? How can there be any connection? And since the assumption is there is a connection, and there is an interrelationship, how could it be that two things that are so different have a connection? God and the physical world. The one and the many. The spiritual and the physical. How could it be? There is a connection. Clearly there is, assumes Kabbalah. How could there be a connection? And what's the nature of that connection?
Human beings are a perfect example of that relationship.
Very good. And Kabbalah will say that perhaps a symbol of God's relationship with the world is the relationship of the soul to the body. Very good. 2 points. We can go one step further. And asking the question, how does God relate to the world? How does the simple relate to the complex? Really, in order to ask that question, you have to go back to its foundation, which is the following. Not only how does God relate to the world as it exists, but how did the world come into existence at all? In other words, if we have a question, how does the one relate to the many? We'll then first ask, how did the one make the many? How could it be that God, who is the all, how could he create something that is so different from him, so puny, right, so physical, when he's so spiritual? How could I make something, I'm talking about God, how can I make something that's not like me at all, that's not connected to me at all?
Because we are made in his image.
How could that be? What does that mean?
That's what it says.
So now let me go deeper into this paradox, the paradox that Kabbalah springs from. Why is it hard to answer the question of how did the world spring from God? Not just because the world is so different from God, but because of the following fundamental paradox. God is the all. God is all-where, everywhere, and nowhere. God is everything. And if God is everything, if God is all, God is in all places and all times, then there's no room for anything else. No room for anything else. And I don't mean physical room, although that's the only way we can think of these things, but it's just a metaphor. There's no room for anything else if God is God.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Wait a second. Yeah. But if you answer, okay, God made room for something else, but if God made room, and I'm using room again, a physical term, only because I have no other terms, but I'm not talking about physicality, if God made room, if God made a place where there's no God, then how could there be in that place a world if there's no God, then there's nothing to sustain?
That doesn't mean God disappears, though.
But if God is not there to make room for the world, then how could the world be sustained and created if God isn't there? Because the world needs God to be sustained.
Yeah, but you're jumping to the conclusion, just because he makes room, he disappears.
Right.
He can
right.
still be there. He can make room and still be there.
How could that be?
How can I?
Well,
he can do anything. He's omniscient.
How do you know?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you understand now the paradox.
Okay.
You're looking for a solution.
All right, so that, it's interesting because I'm trying to match what little I know about astronomy. That assumption is that whether it's three-dimensional, four-dimensional space, that there are boundaries. And that's what's being assumed about the universe by astronomers, that there are, in fact, boundaries. You know, it's more than our world. They're talking about the whole universe, system of the universe. But they're beginning to question that, whether there are boundaries in space, mm-hmm. because space seems to be expanding.
Yeah.
The universe seems to be expanding. But that's an interesting concept, that there are boundaries.
Well, only something with boundaries can expand.
No, well, yeah, you can argue that. But the beginning question of if God is everything, if God is everywhere, if God fills up all that space, it's got to be a boundary of some kind. It's just a philosophical question.
It seems to me that you can... Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What keeps you from saying that man is a part of God?
That's my point also.
I'm sorry, you didn't hear.
God is...
What keeps us from saying that man is a part of God?
Yeah, and in other words, if we're saying God is everywhere, and man, God has allowed man to exist, man being our physical world, then they don't have to be mutually exclusive.
That man is a part of God.
Man is a part of God. Okay. Or, if you want to take it to extreme, you could say that God is made up of man.
That's actually the opposite.
That's what I said, to an extreme.
Look, all these are possible solutions to the basic question. But we want to understand that Kabbalah begins with the basic question and comes to a number of different possible theoretical answers. Dorothy?
My point was the same.
Great minds think alike.
Great minds think alike. That you're a part of God. He made room for us as part of in his, whatever that is.
It's getting complicated. If God made room for us, that means he's not there. Where we are.
I disagree with that.
Okay.
I mean, I can make room for you to sit at a table and we're both still there.
Sure.
You're not in my seat, though. Only I'm in my seat.
We're in the same room.
We're in the same room. But if previously you had taken up all 10 seats and you want to have me sit at the table, you have to evacuate one of the seats so I can sit on it.
That's the physical.
But a spirit doesn't need a physical seat. A spirit can just holler, be anywhere. So that's why God is not still there as a spirit, not as a physical being. So just because he made room for physical man doesn't mean he evacuated the spiritual God.
Okay, fine.
So how do the Kabbalists answer
So I think we can see that in this room we're all searching for some type of compromise. Some type of balance between the two poles. The one pole is that man needs room. Man to be man and the world to be the world needs a certain autonomy, a certain independence, a certain free will. Otherwise, if all we are is part of God's imagination, then we aren't really at all. We haven't really been created as independent creatures, and the assumption is we are independent creatures to some degree. But how could we be independent creatures, and what would support us, what would sustain us if we're independent and autonomous? So there has to be some connection and non-connection to God. There has to be some type of presence and non-presence of God at the same time. And that's what Kabbalah is about. It's about defining the balance and tension between the existence of God and the existence of man. And to be more specific, Kabbalah begins with and is founded upon the hypothesis that God created an intermediate spiritual dimension to connect between him and the world. God created an intermediate spiritual dimension. Wait a second. To connect between him and the world. God cannot connect to the world. God as God cannot connect to the world because he's too different.
Why
It's saying like an apple can have a relationship with the color blue. Or that freedom can interact with a hammer. They're two different. They're two other. How does God relate to the world? How does God make space for the world and at the same time be there in order to sustain it? The answer is God created a step-down mechanism. He created a filter. If you will, He created a placenta through which He could be there and not be there, make room but still sustain. And that step-down mechanism, that intermediate world that's God and not God, is called the world of the Spirit. Of the Spirit. You've heard of some of the Spirit?
Yeah.
Chesed and Gvura and Bina and Keter. Are the Spirit God? No. Are the Spirit God? Yes. Yes and no at the same time. They're a step-down mechanism. They're a filter. They're a placenta. That's the beautiful, beautiful model for what it is. Is the placenta the woman or not the woman? Yes or no? It's part and it's not part.
She generated it.
Right. She generated. God generated the Spirit in order to have a mechanism to relate to the world. And we'll be getting into this as we go further and further and further. And you know what? Let me relate this to things we talked about in the past. We talked about, in the past, seeing God. Right? And we said, no man can see me and live, that the overwhelming spiritual, energetic presence of God, were man to be there, he would be burnt up. He wouldn't exist. That's exactly what we're saying now. Were the world to be created by God, then the world would burn up and not exist. Because the world being directly connected to God, no man can see me and live. No man can be in God's presence. God is too great. God is too overwhelming a presence for him to connect to the world, for him to create the world, for him to be there with the world, because he would just overwhelm it and consume it and completely burn it up. So God has to stay away from the world. But if God stays too far away from the world, then the world has no basis for sustenance. Like think of the following. Think of a planet in the orbit of the sun. Goes too far away, no energy to sustain it. Too close, it's burnt up. You have to have a balance. So the relationship between God and the world has to be a balance of tension. Not too far away and not too close. And the mechanism that allows that relationship of tension, not too far away, not too close, the steps, the intermediate connector, is the world of the Spirit, which are God and not God. Dorothy.
If you accept that, then in which world did God talk to Moses? In the intermediate world or in our world?
God, thank you very much. That's a beautiful way to bring these things into practicality. Moses certainly lived in this world, as far as we believe, as far as we know. But the voice that spoke to him, what was that voice? It couldn't have been the voice of God. Let me hear, the language is going to get me tripped up. Voice of God. If voice of God means the voice that is God, then the voice couldn't have been the voice of God, because it would have burnt Moses up alive. The voice must have been some type of mechanism that represents God, an intermediate between man and God.
Now, Bush. But
okay.
On the other hand, the Bible says that Moses was the only prophet who saw God face to face.
No, so who spoke to God face to face, right? Let's all jump on her for saying that, right? You missed a few classes.
But he had the bush, which could have been the intermediary.
Very good. In other words, there have to be intermediaries, because God is too God, and man is too man, for the twain to meet directly.
You could experience something without seeing it.
You can experience something without seeing it.
So, can't you experience God without having to see Him?
We've talked about seeing and tasting.
Well, that's my point. My point is, since you can do this without actual physical attributes, something I shouldn't, I guess. What I'm getting at is, you don't need this intermediate catalyst, is what I'm getting
at. You don't need this intermediate.
You don't need this intermediate catalyst. Since you can experience something without having to actually physically experience it, you don't have to touch it, you don't have to see it, you don't have to feel it, but it's there. You can experience it. And so consequently, the way I see it, you don't need this intermediate catalyst.
So you can't be a Kabbalist.
Whoa.
But for the Kabbalists, this physical stuff is all a metaphor. But even the spiritual reality of God is too great for human beings to have any experience of. God is the infinite light. God is the all-encompassing existence. How could we even come close to that? The answer is we can't.
That's why we have grandchildren. That's why we have priests.
That's why we have priests.
That's why we have priests.
In a certain sense, that's a very good comment. In a certain sense, if you talk as of the priest as the intermediate between God and his flock, so we're talking about here of the same concept.
But you gave that up.
Perhaps we did, perhaps we didn't. Okay. I wanted to say, yeah. Okay, let's begin the text now. Okay? We're going to begin with Sefer HaBehir. Sefer HaBehir, which used to be on the board, and it means the Book of Illumination, which we said surfaced in the circles of Isaac the Blind, in the late 1100s, the 12th century, in Spain, and it contains much, much, much ancient material that came down in tradition. It's an extremely enigmatic work, collections of different statements that often don't seem to make too much sense. They're symbolic, they're suggestive, they're pregnant with meaning, but the meaning is not always clear. Part of the book deals with the significance of the Hebrew letters. And when I say significance of the Hebrew letters, on the one hand, we know gematria, we've heard of gematria, that every Hebrew letter has a value, numerical value. But Sefer HaBehir works not only with numerical values, it works with the significance of the shapes of the letters. The significance of the shapes of the letters. And let's look at three letters, a samich, an avav, and a bet. A samech and a vav and a bet. Sefer HaBehir claims that all of these three letters have symbolic significance. The samech is completely closed, obviously. And for Sefer HaBehir, the significance of samech is divine immanence. Even pantheism, meaning that God and the world are the same. That this encloses God and the world. That inside is God and the world. God is in the world. And perhaps the world and the God are coterminous. Perhaps similar to things Joe was saying earlier. And we'll use the following metaphor. Had the world been created with a samech, it would be symbolic of the fact, symbolic of the hypothesis, that God is in the world. That the world and God are coterminous. On the other hand, had the world been created with a vav, it would have been exactly the opposite. There would just be a line between God and the world. There would be a border between line and the God. God would be transcended. It would be outside of the world. Other than the world. Instead of the symbolism of samech, that God is in the world. As opposed to the imminence of the samech,
And as opposed to the transcendence of the Vav, the Bet is a compromise. The Bet is a Samech that's not completely closed. The Bet is a Samech that's not completely closed. So the Bet says, you can have your cake and eat it too. Or in other words, the Bet says compromise between immanence and transcendence. The Bet says that, let me put it in these terms, the Bet is closed on three sides, but it's open on one side.
Which means?
Which means a compromise between immanence and transcendence. And as we know, the first letter of the Torah is Bet.
Breishit.
The world was created with a Bet. As the world was created in some type of tension between immanence and transcendence. That God is in the world and not in the world. God is not in the world, but still there's an opening for connection to the world. And now we can read the Sefer Bahir and see where it says what I'm saying. Why is the letter Bet closed on all sides and open in the front? This teaches us that he is the house of the world, the bayit. That God is the bet of the world. Now the word bet, right? The Hebrew letter bet, this word is bet. But you vocalize it differently, and it becomes
bayit.
It becomes bayit. So the letter bet is a bayit. The word bet is a house. And what that means is that God is the house of the universe. The universe lives in God. The universe lives in God. Let's see the way the Sefer Reich says that. God is the place of the world, but the world is not his place. God is the place of the world, right? God is the bet of the world. God is the bite of the world. But the world is not his place. In other words, don't think that there's a world and that's God's place, that God is in the world. No, God is not in the world. If I would draw it like this, that the big circle is the world, the little circle is God, that's wrong. The world is not God's bite. Rather, the opposite is the case. God is the bayit of the world. The big circle is God, and the world is within. God is the bayit of the world.
Isn't that what we said?
I said that this sounds a little bit like what Joe said.
I said that already, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I gave him the credit.
In both directions. Because I also said that you could interpret it as an extreme.
And then I said, yeah, that's the opposite.
Yeah.
That's what we're not saying.
Yeah.
Right? So the claim here is that the world is not in God. No. The world is in God, but God is not in the world. So do not read bet, but rather bayit. It is thus written, with wisdom the house is built, with understanding it's established, with knowledge are its chambers filled. And I'm not exactly sure how the verse is to be interpreted. Let me explain, though, that we are used to the midrashic form in which a claim is made and a verse is used to back it up. It's not that way usually in Kabbalah. When a verse is brought, it's not that the verse is brought to back up the claim. Right? The claim is used to find deeper meaning in the verse.
The claim is used to show you the proper Kabbalistic way to read the verse. And I'm not exactly sure here, and I didn't find it in any commentators. Exactly the way they're reading the verse.
Now, are these words your translation?
Yes, I think, no, this is R.A. Kaplan's translation.
Huh?
This is R.A. Kaplan's translation.
Oh, all right.
So now.
And you agree with the translation?
Who am I? But yes, I agree with the translation.
You're a Hebrew scholar.
A little bit.
That's part of the interpretation, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So anyway, I want to now go one step further. We said that God is the bite of the world. But we also said that the bet is closed on three sides and open on one side. And I think that is indicative of another level of meaning. It's not just that the world is in God. It's rather that the world is provided with space by the world, but there's a little opening, right? The bet, the little opening for God to enter into the world. I would really draw it like this. I would really draw it like this if I could be so audacious. I would draw it like that. In other words, there's the world, and then there's a space in the middle of the world that God has created to allow the world to exist. And the world is within that space. And the world is a little opening, right? That's the opening of the bet, to allow God to flow into it. Because without that space that allows God to flow into the world, there's no world, because there's no sustenance. Something like that. This is all metaphorical and all meta-elusive and hints.
Could you perhaps say that God says, look, I created this world for you. You were on your own. But just in case you need my help, I'm leaving an opening there.
Yes. Yes. And we always need that help. Every second of our existence in order to sustain our existence.
Then we don't, you say that then, you've completely taken away my free will.
And that is exactly the tension that has to be maintained. You're right. If the opening is too large, the world is overwhelmed. If the opening is too small, the world dries up and atrophies because there's no sustenance. It's a tension. And if we wanted to enunciate a philosophy of all of the universes, a Kabbalistic philosophy in one word, the word would have to be balance or tension. It's all about the balance and the tension. Jim, you look bored or something.
No? Listening.
Okay. Let's see another source from Sefer HaBehir. And it says, the bet is its sustenance. It is thus written, in the beginning God created. And of course, in the beginning is Bereshit. It means bet, the beginning God created. Right? In is the bet. Bereshit. Bet, beginning God created. Which means bet is the beginning of creation. Bet is the beginning of creation. In other words, what is the reshit of creation? Bet is the reshit. Reshit is the beginning of creation. And why is bet the beginning of creation? Because again, bet symbolizes that balance between God being there and not being there in the world. What is its function here? What is the function of the bet?
What you're saying is there's a world before God.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
It has to be, because otherwise it doesn't make any sense, because God was the one to make it happen, but there had to be something before God.
Why?
Because otherwise God wouldn't come into it.
No, God is always there. God is everything. God is the infinite light. And at a certain point, God decides in his benevolence to create.
Before creation, there has to be something, because there has to be something God has to be somewhere to create something.
No, God doesn't have to be somewhere. God doesn't need a house. Like we said, the world is not God's house. But God is the world's house.
But there has to be something before creation.
Why?
Because otherwise you can't create anything.
Why?
Because you have to create something, it has to be something before that happens.
No, there's only God. According to the Kabbalists.
Then there's God.
There's just God.
But he was before creation then.
God was before creation, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
So how did he exist before creation?
God is existence. What do you mean, how did God exist? God is everything. God is existence. There's nothing but God. And it was a perfect world. Except, by the way, I can't say there's a perfect world. It was just perfection. There's no world.
There was perfection. You're saying there was something before the creation.
No, just God. And God is perfect. I'm not trying to be cute.
I'm just trying to figure it out here.
There was just God, and then God decided to create the world. We'll come back to that at the end of these sheets. We're going to talk about why God created the world according to the Kabbalists. So it says, what is its function here? What's the function of the bet? The matter may be compared to a king who had a daughter who was good, pleasant, beautiful, and perfect. He married her to a royal prince and clothed, crowned, and bejeweled her, giving her much money. Is it possible for the king to ever leave his daughter? You will agree that it's not. Is it possible for him to be with her constantly? You will also agree that it is not. What can he then do? He can place a window between the two, between him and his daughter. And whenever the father needs the daughter or the daughter needs the father, they can come together through the window. It is thus written, all glorious is the king's daughter inside. Her garment is interwoven with gold. Let's go back and read it again.
Daughter is the world.
Right. So we have a king and a daughter. And the daughter is the world. And the king is God. And the king finds himself in a terrible quandary. And it's the exact quandary we've been talking about for the past hour. And it's the quandary that's at the foundation of all of Kabbalah. The king wants to be with his daughter 24 hours a day. He loves her. He raised her. She comes from his flesh. He can't part with her. On the other hand, he knows that she needs independence. She needs autonomy. That if he stays with her 24 hours a day, she won't have any independent existence. She won't have any good. She won't flourish because she has to be an independent creature. But he can't let go of her. So he can't keep her and he can't let her go. I mean, every parent has the same problem. And God has the same problem with the world, both concerning the world's existence after creation and creation itself.
And that's why they invented the cell phone.
Right. So therefore, the sfirot in Kabbalah can be compared to the cell phone. They are the intermediate step-down mechanism that can connects the king with his daughter. Don't call too often. But don't call too infrequently. There's a balance.
That relationship that they describe here, it doesn't have to be a king with a bejeweled daughter. It could be just any father and a daughter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right, to make it clear
exactly.
That this man is representative of God. He's a king.
Okay.
To make it clear that this daughter is representative of the great world. So she's a princess. So there's a window. He places a window between the two of them. He gives her her own house. He builds for her another palace for the princess and for her husband. But it's not within the palace of the king. That would be too close. And it's not too far away. It's nearby, and there's a window between them. And that window allows us to live with the tension of closeness and distance, of transcendence and immanence.
So that's the space that it's like...
Right. The window is the opening of the bet. The window is the opening of the bet. That the world is closed on three sides. There it's bounded from God. But on one side it's open to God to allow the amount of connection that is necessary for its sustenance, but not too much, such that it would be overwhelmed. Now here, I do understand the significance of the verse that's brought at the end, Psalm 45. All glorious is the king's daughter inside. Her garment is interwoven with gold. In Kabbalistic thought, gold represents a certain sphira that I won't mention now. We didn't get to the spherot. But I'll mention the concept of that sphira. The concept is restraint. The concept is restraint. Gold represents restraint. And the idea is that in the relationship between the king and his daughter, there has to be a large degree of restraint on the part of the king. Because the king's natural inclination is to spend all his time in his daughter's kitchen. He loves her. What can he do? He can't part from her. And it's really hard for the king to cut the umbilical cord. But he knows that if he doesn't cut it, that he won't be doing the best for his daughter. So he has to restrain himself and hold back. But not too much. If he restrains himself and holds back too much, then the daughter will be looking for guidance and help and succor and support. She won't get it, and she'll wither away. Well, so there has to be restraint, but there also has to be enough of an open window.
In Kabbalah, is it a two-way communication? In this case, doesn't the world also have to have restraint? So this might represent restraint on the part of the daughter as well.
I think that's a good point. I don't know enough about it. If we go into the things I'm not familiar with, the Kabbalists believe that they can...
There has to be some kind of communication between the world and God, right?
Right, so the Kabbalist has to restrain himself from trying to interfere too much with God. Okay, right, yeah. That's not my focus, but there's also truth in that. Okay, very good. We're doing okay? Now, as we can all see, although Kabbalah is talking about the upper worlds and the spiritual worlds, God's connection to the world in a very, very theoretical, ethereal sense, we can see that this has great relevance to human psychology and human sociology. And that reminds us of what I said an hour ago, that later Kabbalah, in the form of Hasidut, comes to emphasize the psychological significance of these things, that they're not just descriptions of God in the world, they're descriptions of what happens in our personal lives. So that, it means that we can gain insight into how to live our personal lives from understanding how God relates to the world. That type of balance between transcendence and immanence, between smothering your daughter and giving her too much autonomy, it's the same for me and my daughter, it's the same for God and His world.
How do you describe transcendence and immanence applied to this?
Transcendence is the father who completely distances himself from his daughter. Okay. Immanence is the father who every single morning shows up in her kitchen and doesn't leave.
By the way, the princess doesn't go to the kitchen. She has the cooks.
Okay. The living room.
Yes.
Boy, we can't be literal in this area.
So now, we're going to go from these two passages in Sefer Vayir to a book called Sefer Etz HaChaim, written by the Ari HaKadosh, the Holy Ari. Etz HaChaim by Ari HaKadosh, Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, chapter 1, section 2. We've now skipped to Sfat, Safed, in about the year 1540.
That's when the first book was printed.
Okay, right, the invention of the printing press. About 1540, 1550, perhaps 1560, I don't know exactly when this was written. Now, an academic would say that I am committing a travesty here by learning 1 second Sefer Vayir and another second learning the Ari. An academic would say, you have to see the historical progression, development of the Kabbalah. You have to see that each particular historical period represents and expresses a different way of thinking. One builds upon another, but they're separate systems. Whereas I'm making a salad of it all, because I'm looking at this not from an academic approach, but rather from an insider's approach of Kabbalah. The Kabbalists see it all as one. And they will tell you that everything that the Ari HaKadosh said in the 16th century was already implicit in the Sefer HaBahir of 1,000 years before that. Are you ready? Ready. One must know that before all things were emanated and created, there was a homogeneous supernal light that filled all of reality. And there was no place devoid of it, no empty vacuum. Rather, all was full of that homogeneous infinite light which had no beginning, no end. Right? It goes back to Jim 10 minutes ago. Before creation, it's all or Ein Sof. Or is light, Ein Sof is no end, the infinite light. When the Kabbalists talk about the infinite light, by the way, a modern Kabbalist who wrote in English called his book The Infinite Light. Anyone read that book, Infinite Light? Rabbi David Aaron wrote a book called Infinite Light. So in any case, the infinite light, you could say, is that aspect of God we can talk about. God is Ein Sof. He's the infinite one. You can't even talk about Him. If you want to talk about that of God you can talk about, we don't talk about the infinite, we talk about the infinite light. A little bit more tangible. So something we can get our hands around.
So Ein Sof means no end.
It means no end.
Yeah, so infinite, yeah.
Which no means, end. Basically, it's, as far as we're concerned, Ein Sof is nothing. Right? It's nothing for us. It's everything, and therefore it's nothing. The Or Ein Sof, the light of the Ein Sof, well, that's something we can talk, we can a little bit more grapple with it. It sounds like something tangible. Of course, it's not. But the word light sounds like something you can see. Whereas Ein Sof, infinity, something you can't think about, you can't see, you can't touch, you can't taste. So we're saying in this metaphorical statement that everything was this homogeneous infinite light which had no beginning and no end. Rather, all was one homogeneous, completely uniform light, and it's what we call the infinite light. And when it's homogeneous will to create the worlds, and to emanate the emanations and to actualize its perfect actions, name, and expressions, which is the purpose of creation of the worlds as is explained. What happened when God wanted to make the world? Behold, then the infinite life, infinite, contracted itself. Ah! Contracted itself. Anyone know the word in Hebrew? Contracted? You probably do. You've probably heard it. No? Simtsum? Right? Simtsum. A classic word in Kabbalah. And let me now relate it to the king and his daughter. Tzimtzum is an expression of restraint. Right? How do I translate it? Contraction. Right? I am the father. And I just love my daughter. And I'd like to be with her all day. I have to restrain myself. What does it mean? I have to contract myself. I have to withdraw myself and hold myself back.
But doesn't also contract mean come together?
Get smaller.
Here we're using contract in the sense of I was there, but I contract myself from there. Remember, God is infinite. He has to contract himself to make room for his daughter. It's so beautiful. If you find a better translation for the word Tzimtzum, tell me.
No, I mean, then contract.
So a better word might be withdraw.
Yeah.
But since for many, many years we've been translating Tzimtzum as contract, and all the Kabbalistic texts translated in English, they always say contract. So I will use the word contract.
Okay.
But please understand the relationship between Tzimtzum and restraint. That God and God's light are infinite, and therefore they take up all of space and all of time and all of everything. In all the dimensions you can think of, it's all God.
You see, because
but God has to mitzamtzem. He has to contract himself to make room for his daughter.
But you see, he's contracting himself, as you say, from the middle point.
Yes.
So if you're in the middle, the only way you can get out of the middle is to withdraw. You don't make yourself...
Okay, Harry, that's just semantics.
You know what I'm getting at?
The word in Hebrew seems sum, and understand that it's withdraw. So if everything is God in all planes and all dimensions, then God has to engage in self-restraint, in self-withdrawal, to make some room for the world.
I'm picturing a bowl of jello.
Making room,
you just have to scoop a little bit or move it.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's
good. Then do that.
But the next sentence explains it.
Okay, so let's read on. Behold, then the infinite contracted itself from the middle point within it, from the absolute middle of the light, and contracted that light, and it was distanced from all around that middle point.
Yeah.
So the contraction takes place from the exact middle of the infinity.
So you get a donut hole.
You get a donut hole. Okay.
Yeah, I'm picturing jello. You want donut?
No, I'm picturing a language. Actually, I prefer neither.
This contraction, right, this tzimtzum, was totally uniform around the empty middle point. So that the empty space was absolutely round all about and was not in the form of a rectangle having right angles. This is because the infinite contracted itself in an absolutely circular fashion from all sides. Believe me, this was tremendously difficult to translate. Tremendously difficult. The reason for this was, and I'm leaving out the first reason, three dots. Another reason was, the reason why was the contraction in a circular form. Another reason was for the emanated things that would be emanated afterwards within that empty space, devoid of anything. The matter is that, with the infinite emanated the matter is that with the emanated things being in a circular form, all would be near and connected to the infinite that surrounds them in an absolutely uniform fashion. In other words, God makes this empty space. If the empty space was a rectangle or a triangle, then at any given point within the empty space, you would be X distance from God, and a different point in the empty space, you would be Y distance from God. Whereas what we want is that you could... No, I'll say it differently. I'll say it differently. If we have a triangle, then any given point in the triangle of empty space, is in different directions, it's different distances from God. Whereas we want to have a space such that at a certain point in the space, you're equidistant from God on all sides. Why? Because there has to be some type of constant sustenance from God. Now, here we're getting into the paradox. The paradox is, we make empty space, but in that empty space, there has to be a connection to God, or else it'll be just the empty space, and there won't be any creation in that empty space.
We can derive from that all men are created equal, and then we derive from that the equality of men, democracy, all that. If everybody receives the light of God in the same way, in the same instant,
uh-huh.
The same immensity.
Very interesting. I have not thought about that. Okay? So again, the matter is that, with the emanated things being in a circular form, all would be near and connected to the infinite that surrounds them in an absolutely uniform fashion. Therefore, the light and the overflow that they require will be received by them from all sides uniformly. That word overflow is an important Kabbalistic word, and the word is hashpa'ah. Hashpa'ah. In modern Hebrew, it means influence. In other words, the empty space has to be empty of God in order for something to be created there. But it also has to have an overflow from God. There has to be radiation of God radiating it into it. Otherwise, there'll be no power to create something. There has to be a hashpa'ah. I called it an overflow here. I call it a radiation, an emanation. There has to be some emanation of God into the empty space.
Actually, it's quite a revolutionary thought that's around. Because in that time period, most people thought the world was flat. And to think that it was round.
Well, we didn't say the world is round. We said the empty space that provides space for the world.
I know, but it's a revolutionary thought in a way, only because in that time, everybody believed that the world was flat.
But you say the world, you mean the earth. Whereas we mean the universe.
The universe, they thought the universe was flat. What
okay.
Was the time of the Ari? What was the time of the Ari?
The Ari is the same time as the Ramak, which is the middle of the 16th century.
Well, by that time, wasn't it already determined that the world, the sun, the planets went around the sun? When was it that?
Galileo was around the 14th century.
When was Galileo?
Around the same time.
Endless. The same
but
time.
You have to then think, which may be true, that the news from Rome got to Palestine. And that was accepted. Remember, the church didn't accept it until about 100 years ago.
Now, are we talking about our world, or are we talking about the universe?
The universe.
Okay.
Everything that exists.
Okay.
Had to have this empty space so that it could come into existence. Okay, let's go on a little bit more. This would not be the case had the emanated things been in the space, the form of a rectangle, a triangle, or any other geometric form. For then there might be protruding corners closer to the infinite, and everything would not receive the infinite light uniformly.
Okay. Can I ask you a question? By the emanated things, they really mean the things that are in the world.
The things that are going to come into being in the world.
Yeah, whether it's nature or man or oceans
everything.
Or whatever.
Everything.
This is B.C., before creation.
Yes, very good.
So it seems that this imminent light is all around the universe that's created, but we only have one place for that light to get in.
That's right. If we go back to the metaphor of the bet, then that's the case. And we'll see. I don't remember if I brought a text about this, so I'll just explain it next time. That according to what the Kabbalists say, is that if we have this empty space, then the world was created with the ray of light that went from the infinite light into the middle and hit the middle point. But indeed, there was only one window, if you will. One window into the middle point. Yeah. Now what we're going to do is we're going to read a restatement and a reworking of the statement of the Ari by Rabbi Nachman Mibraslav. And the reason I'm bringing Rabbi Nachman is not so much for any innovation, but just to show you that what the Ari had said in about the year 1540-1550, Rabbi Nachman said 200 years later in his work of Chassidut, Likutei Moharan.
How many years later? You
said I think Rabbi Nachman was a little bit before the year 1800. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, a little bit before the year 1800, Rabbi Nachman. And when God, may He be blessed, wished to create the world, there was no place to create it since all was the infinite. And therefore He contracted the light to the periphery. And through this contraction, this tzimtzum, came into being the empty space. And within this space was brought into existence all the days and characteristics that make up the creation of the world. Now this empty space was a necessary condition for the creation of the world. For without this empty space, there was no place for the creation of the world, as explained. And this contraction of the empty space cannot be understood or fathomed except in the world to come. In other words, you can't understand what I'm saying, and I don't understand what I'm saying. It's just a metaphor for something that I'm hinting to that I don't really understand. And why can't we understand this? Because it's based upon the confluence of two opposites, existence and non-existence. We want to make, in order for there to be existence, you have to create a place of non-existence. Right? To make room for it. But as long as there's non-existence, then there's no sustenance for the existence. That's the paradox which we said an hour and a half ago, and we're still in the same paradox. We'll never get out of it. For the empty space is through contraction, as if divinity was contracted from there, as if there's no divinity there. For otherwise it's not empty space, and everything is the infinite. And there would have been no place for the creation of the world. However, in truth, certainly there is nevertheless divinity there, for nothing can be without its vitality, right? If God was really not there, then he couldn't have created anything there. It is therefore impossible to fathom the matter of the empty space until the future world.
Okay, blah, blah, blah.
But again, the metaphor, which we can't fathom, the metaphor is that God sent in one ray of light from the periphery to the middle point. But it's still a paradox, because if God got to the middle point, then there can't be any creation there, because God is there and he takes up the space. But if God is not there, then there can't be any creation because there's no sustenance. That's the paradox which all the Kabbalah is trying to solve.
The Kabbalists rationalize the world to come, since you would have to leave the world to go into God's presence.
I have no idea. Thank you for the question, but I have no idea. So we're going to end with the Zohar. There's a very, very short, succinct statement in the Zohar that, according to later Kabbalists, hints to everything we're saying. And that one statement is, in Hebrew and then English, Malei kol almin v'sovev kol almin. That God fills all worlds and surrounds all worlds. And again, according to later Kabbalists, what that means is everything we've said for the last hour and a half. What do I mean by that? That when it says God fills all worlds, that means God is everything, God is everywhere, and there's no empty space. When it says God surrounds all worlds, that means that God surrounds a place in the middle that's empty. In other words, the Zohar is saying both sides of the paradox. God is everything, but God has left room for the world at one and the same time. And with that, we've concluded.
Okay.
So can I